Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Last Wednesday, the Oregon Land Use Board of Appeals, known as LUBA, ruled that Portland's fossil fuel terminal zoning amendments, passed unanimously in December of 2016, is inconsistent with the Commerce Clause of the United States Constitution. Portland's fossil fuel policy was intended to prevent new major fossil fuel infrastructure projects in the city. This morning, we talk with Mia Reback, who's with 350 PDX. She's the lead organizer and development coordinator, about what the LUBA ruling means for Portland's ability to determine its own fossil fuel-free future. Mia, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, let's first start by the sort of shocking news that we got last Wednesday. Why was the land use ordinance, basically, which Portland passed last December, which basically bans fossil fuel infrastructure from being built in the future, that's mass storage. Why was this even before the Land Use Board of Appeals?
So, as Barbara said, last December, the Portland City Council unanimously passed an ordinance that would prevent expansions from our existing major fossil fuel facilities, as well as prevent new major infrastructure. A huge, huge win for our local health and safety and for the climate. And not surprisingly, shortly thereafter, Big Oil teamed up with Big Business to file an appeal against the policy. And the Land Use Board of Appeals made their final decision last Wednesday. Definitely a disappointing decision to come out and reverse the ordinance.
And I was a little surprised because usually the Land Use Board of Appeals seems to come out on the right side, at least the right side, of what the environmental community is looking for. Not always, but often. Why do you think that this time LUBA had such a pro-business, and I would say, well, it's interesting. We can get into this whole thing about the Commerce Clause of the Constitution and why it was the ban was denied, basically. But why do you think that LUBA this time around basically took this position?
So, you know, I think that when it comes to the fossil fuel economy, it is pretty well known that, you know, it's not solely in one state. This is a national, international economy. And so it really did seem like the final LUBA decision was almost like, we know that the fossil fuel industry is bigger than the state of Oregon. Therefore, a policy that restricts the fossil fuel industry must therefore negatively impact out-of-state commerce and out-of-state business interests and therefore violate the Dormant Commerce Clause. You know, we think that that was the wrong opinion and the wrong side for this to come down upon, especially because local communities, cities, counties do have the authority to regulate, to protect the health and safety of their residents. And it's imperative that local jurisdictions maintain the ability to protect local health and safety, especially from rogue industries.
Well, Eric DePlace with Sightline Institute wrote a really good article last year that was looking at all the different examples of local communities standing up and putting brakes on fossil fuel development in their communities, and which ones work. Portland was, of course, held up as the role model of the best that you can possibly do. There were a couple communities back east, one which was successful, and the other one, and it was a town right near where I grew up in Massachusetts, and they kind of overreached because they were basically trying to limit what the railroads could do. And so it came down to, you don't want to mess with railroad terminals and with railroad tracks and with railroad trains. But when you're talking about storage facility for fossil fuel, that's a local issue. And in every case where it had come before a higher court, those have been upheld, whereas the ones where they messed around with the railroads don't mess around with the railroads.
Yeah, and so to kind of go back a little bit on the history of this, and so the ordinance that was passed this last December was a follow-on policy to a resolution that the council had passed actually in November of 2015. And following the original resolution, which was a declaration saying the city was opposed to fossil fuel infrastructure in the city of Portland or our adjacent waterways, be it the Columbia and the Willamette Rivers. And that really kind of got the ball moving on a lot of other cities and counties in the Northwest, but also the United States more broadly, to start to look at kind of these local solutions and what local governments can do. And so we've seen a bunch of policies pop up very much reflected in their local context. Some of these are moratoriums against fossil fuels. Some are ordinances. Some are also land use code-based like ours. And we're seeing really creative policy solutions. And similarly, near Spokane, Washington, they tried to pass a policy that would start to fine railroads and rail cars for each car of fossil fuel that came through. So a unit train full of oil train cars, each car would have had a fine tacked onto it, and that was not able to move forward. And so it definitely gets complicated when it comes to the railroads, but we have to be asking these complicated questions and looking for local solutions.
Well, I think that this is another step that people are looking at, which is how do we start approaching the fact that the railroads are like the major oligarch of the United States. Obviously, the fossil fuel companies are hoping to find, the railroads actually have written into all of their charters and everything, this kind of, they transcend any kind of government supervision. The fossil fuel companies don't have that. I don't think they have the same legal clout that the railroad has. Obviously, they're looking to try to ensure that. So I want to just kind of get a sense of, I was actually hoping to get Nick Caliban, because he's your legal whiz, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'm hoping that he's filled your head enough legal wisdom that we can at least get a sense of what legal people who really worked very hard to make the Portland Ordinance legal proof, what's his thought about it? And does this sound to him like a reasonable interpretation of the U.S. Constitution?
So I've talked with Nick Caliban extensively. He's a staff attorney with the Center for Sustainable Economy. They're a fantastic local organization that worked with 350 PDX and others on the original policy. And they're one of the four organizations that have joined the city to defend the policy in the formal appeals process. And his, legal counsel is coming down on the side that disagrees with Luba and says that there is nothing in the public record from the policy process that talks about exports or kind of the broader fossil fuel economy, and that this policy and this process really is about protecting our local health and safety, which local governments have the jurisdiction to do, both in terms of Oregon state law and federal law. And so organizations, nonprofits, as well as the city of Portland are looking into making an appeal. There's 21 days to decide that from when the decision was made, which was last Wednesday. So in the coming weeks, the public will find out whether or not an appeal moves forward.
Now, where would that appeal go to?
That appeal will go first to the state court of appeals. And then if it were to be appealed again, it would move into the federal courts.
And then it could go to the Supreme Court.
Theoretically,
which we hope it
could
doesn't.
Go all the way. I think that that's definitely a gamble, especially in, with the Trump administration, where we have a federal government that is extremely pro fossil fuel infrastructure, which is an extremely backwards approach to, revitalizing the economy and our crumbling infrastructure. But that is the federal context we're in. And so I think that local solutions, keeping things, at the local level, at the state level, is where we're going to be able to see the most progress made, as well as have the most favorable decisions made.
Well, what do you see as the trajectory now in terms of dealing with this? For first of all, were people caught off guard that this decision even came down?
Yes and no. I think that I would say that we have kind of a spectrum of climate optimists to climate cynics. And I think that folks on the more cynical side might take an approach saying the fossil fuel industry will always challenge, they will always push back, and they have all the power, including institutional power and an alignment, with the U.S. government. And then, on the other end of the spectrum are climate optimists, I think, who are saying, no, things are changing. We're starting to have more federal decisions being made in the courts. We're starting to have more agencies make favorable decisions. The industry can change. And so I think different people's reactions kind of fall along this spectrum, where some people were like, yeah, of course, that's what happened, and others were more surprised. But I think the takeaway, or a takeaway, for climate work more broadly is there's no single solution. And something that's so exciting about this ordinance and the approach that Portland is taking is it's getting closer to that. And it's saying, we're not going to play defense anymore. We're not going to keep fighting every individual terminal and every individual proposal, especially for a city like ours that has a port with river access. We are a prime, location for these proposals. And so this policy approach is saying, we're not going to play whack-a-mole anymore. We're going to holistically stop these, because we know that all fossil fuels are bad. We know that no matter the type of fossil fuel, there are these immediate health and safety risks, whether it's train derailments, explosions, gas leaks, oil spills. These have very real impacts to our air quality, our water quality, and things like that. And so we don't really need to evaluate them on a project by project basis because we know that every project will fail that test because it's inherent to what fossil fuels are. That being said, stopping new fossil fuel infrastructure is only a piece of solving the climate crisis and what our local work has to be. And so, yes, we need to keep fighting on this particular pathway because we can't let any new fossil fuel infrastructure be built to, one, meet our climate goals, but also we're already bearing a huge risk from our existing terminals, especially because of the risk of earthquake in the city of Portland.
Actually, I was going to go to a different question, but I want to hit here because this is a real concern. It's all well and good that we are banning future mass storage facilities, and that the term, definition of mass storage got like brought way, way down from what it was in the initial proposal that was brought to the city to vote last year. However, there is, as you mentioned, quite a concern that we have a lot of storage already. Anybody who drives down Highway 30 in, through Linton sees that Linton is basically a sacrifice zone already to fossil fuel. So there's all these different components. There's like the environmental justice component. Where do these facilities, where are they sited? Largely in communities of color and low-income communities. How do we work on that piece at the same time that we're trying to prevent anything new from coming in?
Is, I think, absolutely something that we need to be talking about, which is what is our transition plan away from the fossil fuel industry? And that absolutely needs to be seen through a lens of environmental justice, recognizing that the playing field is not equal and it has never been equal. And that since the founding of this country, certain people and communities, especially the indigenous communities, have borne the brunt of the burden from the extractive economy and the fossil fuel economy. And we see that, you know, playing out in our society today where, you know, as you mentioned, the Linton neighborhood is a sacrifice zone, and that if there were to be a major earthquake, every single fossil fuel storage facility in Portland is predicted to liquefy and fall into the river and catch fire. And it's like the type of fire that can probably not be put out with any human technology that we currently have. And so that's an absolute scenario that is real and is predicted with a 5% chance every year that that could happen. And that's something that we need to avoid. But when we talk about, you know, what does this future look like? I don't want to see the fossil fuel industry just move. I don't want to see these massive oil facilities just pick up and move to a different place in the state of Oregon where they invest a ton of money into new tank farms, commit to another 50 years of fossil fuel, because those same risks of explosion, of derailment, of leaks exist everywhere. They're just magnified in a seismic zone. And, you know, I don't want to see the fossil fuel economy continuing for much longer. And so we need a transition plan. We need to really be looking at our local policies, like the 100% renewable energy policy that was passed by the City Council of June of this year, that said that we're going to transition off of all fossil fuels onto 100% renewable energy, and not just electricity, but everything, including our transportation fuels, which is the bulk of what is being stored at these tank farms. And so we're starting to get policies to start the conversation of what does it look like to move away from these fossil fuel facilities. And I think we need to be having that conversation more intentionally with a tighter timeline and really looking at that local community and especially people employed in those facilities. And how are we going to ensure that that transition is really rooted in justice and equity for those most impacted?
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning about the recent Land Use Board of Appeals of Oregon decision to overturn our very famous and far-leading visionary ban on future fossil fuel infrastructure development here in the city of Portland. So I guess we'll get to what that means in terms of implementing that ban right now. And my guest is Mia Reback, who is the 350 PDX lead organizer and development coordinator. I'm just thinking as you're talking about, you know, getting away from fossil fuels, and I went through one of these ethical dilemmas that several of my friends have. We've had to buy new cars in the last few months, and I was sure that the next new car I was going to buy, because the last one I bought was 14 years ago, was going to be an electric car. Well, the electric car that I need, because I do traveling outside of the city, doesn't exist yet. And so I went ahead, I bought the best fuel efficient and, you know, environmentally sustainable gasoline car I could find that was affordable also, and felt very guilty. It was a very strange feeling. I mean, it's a wonderful car, and every time I get in it, I feel like, you know, I'm hitting my head myself in the head again, like I'm not moving forward. So this is my own personal decision. Magnify that by the, what is it, 1.2 million people in the Portland area, I'm not sure, 1.8 million now, and the 3-point-something million in the state of Oregon. We're all making decisions individually and collectively about our fossil fuel-free future. But what do we need so that we can actually make a decision that we want to make as opposed to one that's kind of forced back on us?
So the part of the kind of organizing theory and approach that we take at 350 PDX is we really look towards the system, and we look at the types of decisions we make that are really, you know, influenced and dictated by what's happening around us. And so it's very important, I think, that we're conscious consumers. However, our choices are so limited, and so we really need to be looking systemically. And so I think, you know, part of that is looking at transportation and saying what needs to dramatically change about our statewide as well as our metro-wide transportation system so people don't need to be as reliant on personal automobiles. And so that's looking at, you know, rapidly increasing transit and making it affordable and having free transit. It's having safer bike infrastructure. It's having sidewalks in East Portland.
It's also having enough bus stops and bus runs. I mean, this is the thing that's frustrating. People go on about how wonderful TriMet is. Well, I lived in New York when I was in college, and actually I'm not sure that the New York transit system is as good now as it was back then, but you could get everywhere in the city by subway or bus. And in Portland, you can't. And I just like trying to go to the People's Climate Action March last spring, and figuring out how to do it by public transit from Selwood was like, it was going to be impossible. So the thing that really blew my mind was going to the Women's March and realizing how the TriMet could not handle half of the city of Portland wanting to ride the transit at the same time. So these are examples of what really needs to change. And I'm wondering if people working with TriMet, with the city, to like go like, get the funding, get more bus lines, get more stops on the MAX lines, do things that really bring the transit to the people, because right now people have to go to the transit.
Absolutely. There's some incredible organizations working on that. I want to make a plug for Opal Environmental Justice Oregon. They're doing some incredible work on transit, especially about ensuring affordable transit as well as youth access to transit, which is really, really great work that organization is doing. And they helped lead the climate march in April of this year, really connecting the dots between our social system and our social crises with the climate crisis.
And ironically, because they chose to have the march be based in a community of color, it was also a community really badly serviced by mass transit. It was much better getting out at Benson High School. There's a bus that goes right by my house, so it was easy to get home. But I think that right there showed like some of the inequities that there's the focus of transit in Portland still, I can't believe it after all the years I've lived here, it still all goes downtown.
Absolutely.
And you forget about the people that live in neighborhoods that don't want to have to go downtown to connect to each other.
Yeah. And so, you know, I think that, you know, our entire social system, the way that we've planned our cities, has been rooted in the fossil fuel economy. And so when we're looking forward and looking at climate change and what needs to be done, we really do need a just transition that holistically looks at everything, and everything's going to need to be transformed. And as individuals, we can't do that. We can only do it by working together, which is going to just make a plug for folks to get involved with an organization that's doing this work, whether it's transit or climate, whatever the issue is that speaks to you most. We're only going to be able to make these changes when we work together. And we absolutely have to make these changes, especially in terms of the fossil fuel industry, because the risk from an explosion or a derailment is too high. We shouldn't be bearing that risk in our community. We've had lots of small accidents and small spills in the Portland metro area just in the last couple of years since we really started having the citywide conversation about fossil fuel infrastructure. And we've been very, very fortunate that none of these have crossed into the catastrophic. Some have gotten very, very close to that. And so we're very, very fortunate that we haven't had, you know, an extreme thing like a Lac-Mégantic derailment. That was an oil train derailment in Lac-Mégantic, Canada, that decimated the entire downtown and 47 people were killed instantaneously in that derailment. We're very, very lucky that, you know, when an oil train derailed in Mosier, Oregon last year, there were no fatalities. We're very, very lucky.
And that was weather. I mean, that was, I think, when people talk about how lucky we were, I mean, the fact that it was like one of maybe 5 days in the year in Mosier where there's not 20-mile-an-hour winds.
Yeah.
In fact, when we were there celebrating or commemorating the first anniversary, and there were the 25-mile-an-hour winds. I was recording it, and I had so much wind noise by recording, and I kept thinking, and I was listening back to the tape, that, boy, if this had been last year, there would be no Mosier left.
Yeah, and so this was an oil train that derailed on a non-windy day, and so the flames and the smoke just burned straight up in a very windy area, and the fire marshal said that if the wind had been blowing, the entire town, including that nearby elementary school, would have caught fire. And oil, when it catches on fire, it's very, very hot. It's not the same as a house fire. It can't be put out in the same way. And so we shouldn't be just banking on this luck. You know, we know that these risks are here, and we know that we're facing them and taking this gamble every single day. And these policies are starting to get at the fact that we shouldn't be bearing these risks anymore, and we shouldn't just be taking that as the status quo and the default, and we should be pushing back. And the city's doing it, and the industry's fighting back. And so we as a community have to come together to both support the city in continuing to pass other policies, as well as in our own lives, taking action to really implement this transition away from the fossil fuel industry.
Well, I want to get back to this city ordinance that's been thrown out by LUBA. Eric DePlace, who I mentioned earlier from Sightline, did an article. Actually, he was on the show just a couple weeks ago talking about the most threatened areas in the Pacific Northwest threatened by fossil fuel industry. Portland was 10 on the list. And I asked him why, and he said, well, you're 10 because you actually had the threat of an actual mass storage facility, the Pembina facility, that was, 3 years ago being planned to be put across from, in the port of Portland.
Mm-hmm.
And that we are 10 because, we're not lower down on the list. I mean, that one was defeated, but we're not lower down on the list because we have this ordinance. So now that the ordinance has been taken away from us, do you feel like this makes Portland more of a threatened area in terms of having more fossil fuel companies coming in and trying to build things here?
There's definitely the potential for that. I think with the ordinance having been reversed, we could see a new proposal either for an expansion at an existing facility or for just a new facility in general. I also think that it would be very, very silly for the fossil fuel industry to think that just because this ordinance was reversed, that we want them here, because we don't. And they will meet fierce opposition if they come and try to build a new facility or to expand, both from, you know, local government as well as from the general public.
I'm actually thinking of two buzzwords for the fossil fuel industry to come mess with Portland. First one is Fenneca, and the first one should be Pembina, and the second one is Fenneca. Well, let's talk a little bit about those two battles and what they show about how little Portland welcomes the fossil fuel industry.
Yeah, so back in 2014, fall of 2014, we got word that Pembina Pipeline Corporation, a Canadian company, had its sights on Portland. They wanted to build a $500 million propane export facility. It would have been the largest investment in the city of Portland, and it would have brought into the city over 37,000 barrels of propane gas by train every single day. The Oregonian actually did an analysis and found that 1/4 of Portland residents would have been at risk from a train derailment and subsequent explosion just from the trains bringing the propane gas to this terminal.
And I want to do a rare shout out to the Oregonian, because they actually broke the story. And that's how you and I had Eric DePlace on my show that morning, and we'd all just found out about it. So that's another concern, was like, who was doing the negotiations and why did it take the Oregonian to break the story?
Yeah, and so when the company wanted to come, the Port of Portland, as well as then Mayor Charlie Hales, actually celebrated Pembina coming as a great economic investment for the city. And there would not have actually been any public process, except Pembina needed to build a few hundred feet of pipeline through an environmental overlay zone, which required them to actually get a zoning code change in their favor. And that started a public process. And when community organizations, as well as just general, you know, community members got word of this, that public process stopped being about a few hundred feet of pipe, and it became an entire referendum on climate change and the fossil fuel industry and Portland's role in it. And by the end of that process, Mayor Charlie Hales had received 3,000 phone calls and emails opposing the Pembina facility, and only 3 in favor of it. And that was the moment in time when he reversed his support for the decision, said the city council would not move forward to hear the zoning code change that was requested by the company. And that kind of essentially killed the project. Pembina Pipeline Company formally said that they're rescinding their application. They don't want to be in Portland after the city council passed a resolution in November of 2015 saying they opposed fossil fuel infrastructure.
Yeah, one of my few favorite quotes of Charlie Hales. He said in the radio documentary, I just did Sacrifice Zones, where we talk a little bit about Pembina. He said, there was more agreement in the city of Portland opposing Pembina than there was which direction the sun rose in the morning. And he's probably right.
Yeah, and so, you know, I think especially when you talk about risk in the fossil fuel economy, when we're talking about these export facilities, which is a little bit different than when we're talking about storage facilities for our local usage, because we bear all the risk. It's fracked gas from Canada transported through our community. We bear the risk of derailment and explosion. There are a few jobs, not a lot. Gas moves on. When we're talking about, you know, the fossil fuel ordinance that was passed, that was really, really rooted in the facilities for Oregon and Southern Washington, our local transportation fuels, where we do benefit from it, and we also have more control to move away from it. And so I think it is important just to note that distinction, especially in relationship to the LUBA decision, how it relates to international commerce, that we really are talking about facilities in Portland for Portland, where, you know, we're bearing the risk of explosion and we just need to move away from fossil fuels.
So actually the Pembina facility would have been, if Portland had ruled to oppose it, that could have been overruled by LUBA on the basis of a, the Commerce Clause of the Constitution. Because it's a transport and it ultimately involved the railroads.
Theoretically, I think that there could have potentially been some grounds to appeal if the city council had heard the zoning code request, said no, and then the company could have appealed.
But I'm thinking, on the other hand, there was a lot of storage involved, too.
Yeah.
So that would have gotten it out on the storage part.
Yeah. And then the other buzzword that you mentioned, the Fenneca, I think is a really important part of the story and the narrative of how Portland became such a powerhouse fighting the fossil fuel industry. So just after, you know, winning the Pembina campaign, Mayor Charlie Hales has reversed his decision. He is now anti-fracked gas, connecting the dots between all fossil fuels, coal, oil, and gas as all bad for our health and safety and the climate. We get word that Shell Oil, in their quest to start exploratory drilling in the Arctic, had a little mishap. And one of their boats, the Fenneca, actually ran into an iceberg.
Taking a shortcut.
taking a shortcut, and had to come back to the continental United States for key repairs. One thing that made this boat really important is it actually was the boat that contained critical safety equipment that Shell needed to meet their permit requirements to start exploratory drilling. So it really was the final thing that Shell needed in the Arctic to start this drilling. And here it is turning around, coming back to Portland. And we saw over the course of a few weeks, thousands of people mobilize and take action, whether it was coming to rallies, kayaking, and then of course that final showdown with the Greenpeace climbers hanging off the St. John's Bridge, a roaming kayak blockade that lasted about 40 hours with hundreds of people cycling in and out. That was Portland showing our commitment. You know, for years we'd been saying, if you build it, we will block it. People been going to hearings, submitting public comments, coming to city council meetings. And finally, here was this moment where we were confronted with a physical thing that we needed to stop, and people did. And that's, I think, a beautiful, beautiful example of our resistance and how it works.
And actually, kind of as a coda to that, I mean, Fenneca finally, after was 40 hours, it got through. The Greenpeace danglers, some were arrested, I think some weren't, but they came down. One was cut down, and the rest of them came down on their own. Fenneca went back up to Alaska. And then just 2 months later, Shell withdrew its request for drilling in the Arctic. And it seems that they had such a narrow window to do it that, in fact, the 40 hours cut into their window.
Yeah, and so they did have a very narrow window just because of sea ice, of when they could do this exploratory drilling. And then when they did rescind their permits, they cited public opposition as one of the many reasons. And here in Portland, we were just one of many, many cities that was really resisting and fighting back against Shell at that time, along with Seattle, as well as people around the world. And it was a really, really exciting moment that I think fundamentally changed the game of what climate action looks like in Portland.
I just had a thought. I was on the New York Times website back, it's 2 years ago now, I guess, and I saw that iconic photo of the danglers from the St. John's Bridge, and it was in there, like the news items were following around the world. And it was the first time I saw an iconic Portland image. It was so much better than seeing like Portlandia. You know, and I just remember like my heart surging and realizing that this was not just a local story. But it also, I think we showed something to the world that I want you to talk about that really changed the conversation. It also changed the level of activism.
So a few weeks before the Portland Fenica showdown, there was actually a massive wave of resistance in Seattle, where the Polar Pioneer, one of the rigs, was docked in Seattle, and folks had been mobilizing against it for months. And people did use Chi activism and direct action to try to stop the Polar Pioneer from leaving the port of Seattle, and the Polar Pioneer made it through. And the whole world was watching that, and I think that there was this feeling of defeat, actually, you know, in the climate movement. It's hard when we fight so hard, you know, we're putting our bodies on the line, but also, you know, sometimes in these moments of big direct actions, you put everything else on hold because the calling is so strong, and it can feel really bad when to lose. And it definitely felt like a loss. And then when the Fenica thing happened was sort of this moment for redemption almost. And I think as, you know, we heard this in Portland and many of us had been going up to Seattle, we're a very tightly networked regional movement. We support everyone's work in the Pacific Northwest. So we really felt that loss here too. When we heard the Fenica was coming, this was our opportunity and our moment for round two and to really do something again. And, you know, folks in Seattle who've been fighting felt that too. And I think that the whole world had been watching. And so when they saw this second wave of resistance and that it came back louder and fiercer with more people, that I think was really, really inspiring. It was incredibly inspiring to me to experience it, to really see the city erupt and mobilize in that way. And I think the visual of the, you know, hundreds of people lining the shores of the Willamette River, they're watching and supporting in the park as people were in the kayaks and hanging from the bridge, starts to show, you know, what it can look like for a city to really support a direct action campaign and to really be in solidarity with those putting their bodies on the line to confront the most dangerous industry in the world.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Mia Reback, who is the 350 PDX lead organizer and development coordinator. We're talking, well, we started out talking about the Oregon Land Use Board of Appeals denial of or overturning Portland's landmark fossil fuel mass storage ban that was instituted last December and the consequences of that and the struggle forward. And we're sort of free ranging now about down memory lane about how we got to this point. I have had a number of conversations again with Eric DePlace and other people at Sightline who talk about the choke point, that the Northwest is a choke point between the sources of fossil fuel, whether it's frack gas in the Bakken, frack gas and oil in the Bakken, frack gas in British Columbia and Colorado, coal from Wyoming, that it all has to come through the Columbia Gorge and through the ports along the lower Columbia River to get to those lucrative ports in Asia. And when I saw the Greenpeace climbers dangling from the St. John's Bridge, I mean, I actually remember seeing them as I was heading towards the park and could see them from Highway 30. And then when I got down there and just saw the whole scene, I thought, choke point. This is an incredible metaphor. I mean, because it was a narrow place in the river. And that was one advantage we had over Seattle trying to block all of Puget Sound.
Absolutely. I think that what Eric DePlace is talking about is spot on. there's a ton of fossil fuels being extracted kind of in the inner continent of North America. So whether that's the Bakken of North Dakota, there's tar sands in Utah, fracking fields in Colorado.
And tar sands in the Alberta, we can't
forget
those.
Yeah, of course, the Alberta tar sands, there's fracking fields in Alberta and British Columbia, tons of coal mining in Wyoming and Montana. But there's only so many rivers and so many rail lines. And the rivers and the rail lines are essential to taking these fossil fuels from the site of extraction to market, whether that is fuels being refined for use here in the United States or exported to the global market. And so that's what makes cities like Portland, as well as, you know, Olympia, Seattle, Tacoma, Longview, sites for so many of these proposals. And it's also what gives us power, because there's only so many options of where these companies can go. And so when we network our resistance, which we are doing, and when we work together, you know, we can start to build, whether it's the thin green wall or the thick green line, whatever people want to call it, that line of resistance up and down the West Coast. And it really does include California too. There's a lot of anti-fossil fuel organizing happening there. You know, all from California up through British Columbia and Alaska, we're saying no to the fossil fuel industry.
I'm just thinking about Richmond, California, where I've spent a lot of time in the last few years, and thinking about this company town that's completely dominated by the Chevron Richmond refinery, which has now overturned its Richmond heavy city council and has a city council of all progressives, a mayor who actually ran against the Chevron candidate a few years ago, and he's the conservative now on the city council, and that they are really pushing back. And it's interesting to see a town that was basically an oil refinery town really reclaiming its identity as they want to be one of the greenest cities in the country, and they're working towards it. So I see that as a real model for us too. That, I mean, here we haven't really experienced, outside of Anacortes and a few, you know, maybe Tacoma, there hasn't been a great deal of experience here in the Northwest being a fossil fuel sacrifice zone. So what can we learn from a place like Richmond, particularly when they rise up, and how can we also join forces with the communities that have been saturated by fossil fuel that are kind of coming out of the muck?
Yeah, I think Richmond is an incredibly inspiring example of a city. There's a great, great book called Refinery Town, written by Steve Early, that for folks who want to kind of get the full history of what they did there and how they did it, I recommend reading that book. But in Richmond, what's so inspiring to me about it is, you know, because it was a refinery town, you know, a company town, they're so economically dependent on the Chevron refinery. And we're all economically dependent on the fossil fuel industry. It really is the bedrock of the U.S. economic capitalist system. But when in a company town, it's a lot more pronounced and apparent, that relationship. And so therefore, when the folks in Richmond formed the Richmond Progressive Alliance to get real community members who are not Chevron candidates elected on the city council, they had to recognize that, yes, people were very economically dependent. A lot of jobs in that town came from the refinery, but that they could still say no. And I think that is why we're really seeing a lot of this just transition framework is being really developed in Richmond and coming from them, saying, you know, we need to shut down the fossil fuel industry. It's making us sick and it is killing us. But in so many places, it's also the thing putting food on the table and paying the medical bills. And so we need to find a way to have the right job training for people most impacted. We need to ensure that community members nearby to these facilities that have been bearing the burden of the health impacts are taken care of. And that we can do these things while we're saying no and really, you know, developing the renewable energy economy that is really, you know, regenerative and resilient and based on healthy communities.
Well, it wasn't that long ago. It was before 2011 or 2010 and the Deepwater Horizon spill that BP was changed their name from British Petroleum to Beyond Petroleum, and was at least touting themselves that they're doing all kinds of renewable energy stuff. So what happened to BP? And it seems like, I mean, at the same time that Exxon is like hiding their climate change studies, but there was a movement in the early part of the century for fossil fuel companies to start looking beyond petroleum and thinking about becoming the great leaders in renewable energy.
So I think there are kind of two separate things that have happened. One is a massive amount of greenwashing. I think this is probably the most pronounced thing that we see in BP changing their name from British Petroleum to Beyond Petroleum is a perfect example of greenwashing. Greenwashing is essentially green branding, using good PR, slogans, imagery to make the public think something is a lot more sustainable than it is. And I think we've most confronted this greenwashing with natural gas. So this is fracked gas. It is way, way more polluting and worse for the climate than coal and carbon dioxide, because the methane gas from fracking is way, way worse for the climate, as well as the fracking process is extremely, extremely damaging to local water systems, very toxic and polluting. But the fossil fuel industry branded it natural gas and a cleaner, greener fossil fuel alternative. So we've seen a lot of these like big oil companies like BP and folks start to kind of tout natural gas as part of their solution. And Shell Oil actually has this hilarious commercial. They have these like very like hip, young, punk looking people. They totally look like they would be my friends. They talk about how they're makers and they're all into DIY and they're making their own solar panels from like found electronics. It's just like very, very cool. But then the commercial goes on and they're like, but the renewable energy solution isn't there yet. And for now, we need natural gas. And clean burning natural gas is the bridge to renewable energy. And that is absolutely false. And when the city of Portland said no to Pembina, we were saying no to that false solution that natural gas is a bridge fuel. When we passed this ordinance and these policies that connect all fossil fuels and they treat gas the same as coal and oil, we're saying we don't believe this greenwashing. We don't believe this bridge fuel false solution. And so, you know, I think when we talk about renewables, we're seeing this happening. We're even seeing our utility companies doing this as well. You know, even with the great, great things that Portland General Electric is saying about supporting the city council move to 100% renewable energy, they've suspended their permits for the Cardi fracked gas power plants. But we still need to keep the pressure on them to not pursue other natural gas or other fracked gas.
Actually, that leads me to a teaser for my next week's show, which is going to be about the proposed methanol refinery in Kalama, which involves building more pipelines to bring this natural gas, so-called natural gas, to Kalama. And PGE, I think, has been behind that too. So I think you have to really watch PGE very carefully.
Yeah, and you know, one thing I think that's super interesting, just kind of the tie between PGE actually and the LUBA appeal, is the Portland Business Alliance. And so the Portland Business Alliance represents a lot of the large businesses and industries in the city of Portland. They have a lot of political power at city council and in other spaces. And they teamed up with Big Oil to fight this ordinance. And so, you know, we would expect the Western States Petroleum Association, they represent Exxon, Chevron, BP, Shell, Tesoro. We expected them to fight back and appeal. I think what was surprising was when the Portland Business Alliance joined them to fight back against this.
Now, who's in the Portland Business Alliance?
The Portland Business Alliance represents a lot of businesses in the city of Portland. They have over 60 members, though, that are more a part of their voting board, and that includes healthcare companies like Moda Health, Kaiser Health. It includes the Timbers. It includes our utility companies, a lot of real estate developers, full spectrum of businesses. And actually, many of these businesses have signed on to, in the past, this thing called the Oregon Climate Declaration, and most recently signed on to a business climate declaration of businesses that are saying that they want to maintain the Paris Accord. So this is in response to Donald Trump pulling out of Paris. All these Portland businesses signed on saying that they support Paris. But the only thing that actually can lead us to meeting the goals of the Paris Climate Accord, keeping global warming below 2 degrees Celsius, is to stop all new fossil fuel infrastructure and have a managed decline, a just transition away from our existing facilities. So it's extremely hypocritical for businesses to say that they support Paris while fighting back or fighting against the local implementation of Paris.
I want to know why they're doing that. I mean, that's what really blows me away. And I also think, I think the Portland Business Alliance also came out against Measure 97, as I believe. So there's something afoot there.
Yeah, you know, I can only reduce it down to the fact that the Portland Business Alliance, they represent big business, extremely entrenched in the status quo, And the status quo is fossil fuels and the fossil fuel economy. They're deeply, deeply related. And so we really need to see the businesses in the Portland Business Alliance, as well as the entity as a whole, to break away from that and cut the cord with the fossil fuel industry.
Well, is there an attempt, sort of like with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, to get individual businesses to disengage from the Business Alliance unless they change their position?
At this point, I don't know of a formal campaign to do that, but I think that is definitely something that we would like to see happen, and to see these businesses really putting pressure on the broader alliance. You know, and I think that, so as I was kind of learning more about the Portland Business Alliance, I noticed that Portland General Electric Vice President Dave Robertson is actually their chair-elect, so he will be the chair of the board. And recently, in the last few months, Portland General Electric has really come out and said that they are ready to shift away from all fossil fuels. They've said they are going to suspend permits to permit applications to build two new fracked gas power plants. They've said that they want to pursue moving forward only renewable energy infrastructure projects, which is really, really great. They're supporting the city of Portland's policy to transition off of all fossil fuels onto 100% renewable energy. And so this here is a moment for them to walk their talk a little bit more. And, you know, we really want to see in this new role, PGE, as in such a political power role in the Portland Business Alliance, to really say, you know what, we're doing things differently from now on. We're not going to fight back against local fossil fuel policies.
So how are you going to put pressure on PGE?
Doing it right now on the radio, PGE, we really want to see you coming out and supporting this ordinance and continuing the work to move away from fossil fuels. And the general public can also get involved in this too. The general public, you can call any business. All businesses have phone numbers listed on their website. If they're a member of the Portland Business Alliance, give them a call. Ask them if they know that the Portland Business Alliance is making these decisions in their name. And if they don't know and they disagree with it, ask them to call the Portland Business Alliance and tell them not to do this in their name. And so even though, you know, LUBA did make the decision to reverse the ordinance last Wednesday, this is not the end of the story when it comes to this policy and future climate action. And so there's tons and tons that people can still do.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with Mia Reback, who's with 350 PDX, and we're talking about the Oregon Land Use Board of Appeals decision to rescind the landmark ordinance that Portland City Council passed last December to ban any future fossil fuel storage facilities in the city of Portland. So I just was wondering, besides calling people, or is there any petition campaign? Are there? I'm sort of imagining one of those Credo online petitions, or maybe working with Onward Oregon or something to really push it so you get more of a groundswell of grassroots support.
Yeah, and so right now, kind of the where we're at is the city of Portland, as well as the organizations that formally intervened on the appeal, that's Columbia Riverkeeper, Physicians for Social Responsibility, the Center for Sustainable Economy, and Portland Audubon, have 21 days from last Wednesday, so about 2 weeks from now, to decide if they're going to appeal. And if they're going to appeal this case, we're going to need a ton of public support to help with funding for that appeal, as well as to just continue building our movement. Policy tools are just one way that we're fighting back against the industry. And there's also tons of action that we can take in the streets, including direct action like the Fenneca action, to also fight back against the industry. And we're going to need people to do that too.
Dangle from the windows of Portland Business Alliance. Actually, I'm wondering, what's the city doing? Because this is, after all, a city ordinance. So is the city fighting this too?
So the city is reviewing the ruling and exploring the possibility of an appeal. It was a 95-page ruling that came out last week, and so lawyers are just taking their time to go through it. Mayor Ted Wheeler released a statement that said, "This decision is disappointing and goes against the interests of our community. It is incumbent upon us to protect our residents from the enormous risks posed by fossil fuels. Additionally, we will continue to work with environmental energy and resiliency experts to ensure PDX remains a leader on these issues." So Mayor Wheeler and the City of Portland have said that they are looking into an appeal, and they're kind of currently reviewing that right now this week with their attorneys, but are also, you know, really committed to the underlying ethos and values of this policy. and to really look at what else can be done.
Because I don't want to see us turn into another Denton, Texas, where we passed a city that passed a really strong anti-fracking ordinance, no fracking within the city limits of Denton, overridden by the very right-wing state legislature in Texas. I don't think we have the same issue with our state legislature here, but obviously LUBA is not our friend.
Well, interesting that you bring up the state legislature, because there's another entity called PacWest, and PacWest is a communications firm that represents all sorts of businesses, including the fossil fuel industry. And PacWest actually wrote a bill, and they were able to find a Republican state legislator in Oregon to introduce it that would have preempted this ordinance, yeah. But it didn't move forward at all. It never got a hearing. It never saw the light of day because that is absolutely ridiculous. So we did see an attempt to preempt. And what's, I think, very interesting is the text of this bill actually said introduced at the request of PacWest. So it was a very, very clear fossil fuel industry trying to distort democracy.
Sounds like the state of Oklahoma. Well, in the remaining few minutes, I want to talk about what's going on right now in Burnaby, British Columbia. We both got emails on our way into the station today. So what's happening
there? Yeah, and so up in British Columbia, Kinder Morgan, very, very evil fossil fuel company. They have proposals there to build new major pipelines to feed large fossil fuel terminals. And six individuals this morning have locked down, taking nonviolent direct action to stop Kinder Morgan. This is a very, very powerful and inspiring display of resistance. We're seeing these resistance movements really pop up all across North America and the world, people putting their bodies on the line to confront the fossil fuel industry.
And this is the Trans Mountain Pipeline, which is an existing pipeline. It was built, I think, in a long time ago. It was actually built before Kinder Morgan took over the pipeline. But Kinder Morgan took it over a number of years ago and is trying to expand it. And it's piping basically tar sands oil from northeastern Alberta to Burnaby, which is right adjacent to Vancouver. An interesting note to end on. We all think of Vancouver, BC, as being this wonderful, amazing, gorgeous green city and the most glorious setting in the world. It also has a huge amount of fossil fuel facilities. And this is an example. This is not a new thing they're trying to fight. This facility, the terminal that Kinder Morgan has in Burnaby, is very, very old.
Yeah. And so, you know, I think it's really great that we're talking about Canada because, you know, we really need to be looking at this entire energy system holistically. It's fossil fuels extracted from the intercontinent that are then shipped and transported, whether it goes to power plants for our own electricity here, refineries for our own transportation fuels, our own heating from gas, or being shipped to global market. It's one economic functioning beast, and the whole thing has to go.
Well, it's great to have you, Mia, finally. I've seen you many, many times leading chants and other things at many rallies. And also remember that notable photograph that was taken right after the city council voted to pass the ordinance in the atrium of City Hall. And that's the photograph that we have on our webpage today. So remember some very happy moments and hope that we can reinstate those.
Yes, absolutely. And thank you so much for having me on.
So we'll keep posted and keep me posted as the this passes through I'd like to know if the appeal is going to happen. And this show is going to be going into reruns in the month of August while I take some time off. But back in September, we should check in again too.
Great. Yeah. And for folks listening, you can check out 350pdx.org and we'll be posting updates in the coming weeks.
That sounds great. Well, thanks a lot for joining
us.
I've been talking this morning with Mia Reback, who is 350pdx's lead organizer and development coordinator. And you've been listening to Locust Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locust-focus. Next week, we talk more about the fossil fuel threat to the Northwest. My guest will be Jasmine Zimmer-Stuckey with Columbia Riverkeeper, who's been working with community members in Kalama, Washington, to stop a proposed methanol refinery from being built there. I'm Barbara Bernstein. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. We're going to go out with some music by Anna Fritz that was recorded right after those Fennica protesters, the danglers from the bridge were cut down and people gathered for a very large rally that evening by the St. John's Bridge. Thanks for listening.
Coal, oil, gas, none of these shall pass. leave it in the ground, turn the ships around. Coal, oil, gas, none of these shall pass. Leave it in the ground, turn the ships around. Keep it going. Cascadia is a place of great power. We stand at the mouth of the river, rooted to the land and its people. We turn the ships around. Cascadia is a place of great power. We stand at the mouth of the river, rooted to the land and its people. We turn the ships around. Coal, oil, gas, none of these shall pass. Leave it in the ground, turn the ships around. We are a people. We are a people awakening. We are a people reclaiming. We are a people demanding. Turn the ships around. We are a people awakening. We are a people reclaiming. We are a people demanding. Turn the ships around. Coal, oil, gas, none of these shall pass. Leave it in the ground and turn the ships around. Mm.